This is Speaking of Writers. I'm Steve Richards. To the framers of the Constitution, political parties were a fatal threat to Republican virtues. They had suffered the consequences of partisan politics in Britain before the American Revolution, and they wanted nothing similar for America. Yet parties emerged even before the Constitution was ratified, and they took firmer root in the following decade. In the new book, Founding Partisans, master historian H.W. Brands has crafted a fresh and lively narrative of the early years of the Republic as the Founding Fathers fought one another with competing visions of what our nation would be. H.W. Brands holds the Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin. He has written more than a dozen biographies and histories, including The General versus the President, a New York Times bestseller, and Our First Civil War, his most recent book. Two of his biographies, The First American and Traitor to His Class, were finalists for the Pulitzer Prize. Happy to have H.W. Brands back on this program. Welcome, Bill.
Delighted to be joining you, Steve.
So who are the founding partisans?
Well, they're sort of all of the founders, because with the exception of George Washington. So I use the term advisedly. Founding fathers is something that rolls off the tongue and attracts our ear, but partisans is something we tend to think of as something that emerged more recently. The point that I make in the book is America has been partisan from the beginning. And as you point out, it was against the expectation, against the hopes of the framers, of the founders, because they had created this new republic, pulled it away from Britain. They thought they had been thereby spared themselves the bitter politics that had given rise to the bad laws that had prompted the American Revolution. So the country had been split during the Revolutionary War, but the losers, the loyalists, they left. So all the people who remained all agreed. And they thought, we will continue to agree as the country moves forward into peace. But it turned out that these were men of strong mind, strong will, of ambition, and they didn't agree on everything. And it's in the nature of human affairs, I believe, that disagreements sort of tend to rise to the top. You can disagree about one thing, clear that away, solve that problem, and something else emerges. So against their best wishes, at least against the best wishes that they expressed. Now, I still haven't convinced myself that deep down, they didn't think something like this was going to happen because, you know, these were practical men. These are people who had been in politics. There were party politics in the colonies. So in each colony, there were different political factions, but they certainly spoke as though this wasn't going to happen. Some of them spoke as though this must not happen, that a republic required civic virtue. And virtue was something they considered to be just the opposite of partisanship. Nonetheless, the parties arose.
What were some of the divisions between Hamilton, Madison, Jefferson, and Adams?
The differences of opinion they had, as you suggest, were different visions for America, and they're strikingly similar to the different visions we have today. At the heart of it is, do you trust government to do the right thing? If you do, then you're more inclined to grant government greater power. If you think not, then you want to make sure that government doesn't become too powerful. There's the question in a federal republic, such as we have and have had since the beginning, in the continuing competition between the state governments and the federal government. Where do your loyalties, where do your greater expectations lie? So do you want bigger government? Do you want smaller government? Do you prefer the states? Do you prefer the federal government? Those are at the heart of it. Then there's the question of property, class. So whose interest is government supposed to serve? Is it supposed to serve the interests of the wealthy, of the business classes? Are we supposed to give sort of the talented tenth, the top 1%? Are they supposed to have the greatest opportunity to maximize their gains? And maybe those will trickle down to the rest. Or should government cultivate the people at the bottom, the ordinary people of America? In those days, more than today, there was a split between city and country. Now, America is mostly urban today, but there's still a rural part of America. In those days, America was overwhelmingly rural and agrarian. So is it the farmers that government should cultivate, or is it the cities? What's the future of America? Where does the soul of America lie? We argue about these today. They started arguing about them maybe back in the 1780s and 90s.
Let's talk about the Federalists here, Hamilton and Madison. What happened to the Federalists?
Well, so the Federalists emerged really as just this grouping. You can't even call them a party, a grouping in favor of ratification of the Constitution. And it's a ratification of a new federal constitution, hence the name. And the name also comes from the fact that they, that their leaders, Madison, Hamilton, and add in John Jay, they wrote a series of opinion pieces, op-ed pieces, in favor of ratification that were collected as the Federalist Papers. So these are the Federalists, and they want this new constitution, which was substantially more powerful than the constitution it replaced. It's worth a reminder that the constitution that we've been living under is the second Trump. We had a constitution before this, and this was the Articles of Confederation, which was really much more like a loose wartime alliance rather than a unified government. And people like Madison and Hamilton thought that was entirely insufficient to the needs of this new country. So they said, we've got to replace it with this new constitution. They were the ones who spearheaded the Constitutional Convention, wrote the Constitution, and then they have to persuade the country to go along. So their group, the Federalists, they said, ratify this new thing. Against them were the ones who thought, this is not an improvement over the Constitution we have. We're skeptical. We fought a revolution against Britain and King George because that government was too powerful. We would be foolish to repeat the mistake and hand excess power to this new central government of America. Instead of King George III, we might have King George Washington I. We don't want to do that. And so this group, unfortunately for them, they were kind of labeled by default, they were the anti-Federalists. But in fact, so this was the grouping that geared up for the fight over ratification. The Federalists won, but then it turned out that many of the divisions persisted into the operation of the new republic under the new constitution.
Bill, where did Washington fall within this framework?
So Washington liked to portray himself as being above party. So within his administration, the leaders of the two emerging parties, Hamilton, who was leader of the Federalists, and Jefferson, who was leader of the Republicans, they're bickering between each other. And every time they sit down for a cabinet meeting and they're giving advice to the president, it's conflicting. And Hamilton says, stronger government. We want a national bank. We want, you know, more activity, more energy at the center. And Jefferson is saying, no. We want to leave it to the states. We want to make sure that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. And Washington has to adjudicate between these two positions. And so he takes the position that, no, I'm above party politics. And in some ways he was, because Washington, with the exception of Benjamin Franklin, who actually dies in 1790, just as the new government is getting up and running, he's a generation older than the rest of these people. And his ambitions are essentially behind him. He really likes to think of himself as the General Washington. And he takes the presidency simply as a victory lap after having guided the country to independence. And so he doesn't see any advantage for him. In fact, he doesn't think there's much advantage in the country in letting these partisan views take hold. So he sits above this. Now, in fact, his political leanings were all on the side of Hamilton. He was a Federalist at heart, but he was not officially a Federalist or a Republican.
What's the real test of any new system?
So if you set up a new government, holding the first election is no problem. Okay, you hold the first election, the winners take office. The second one is not necessarily a problem unless, so the real test is, when does the party in power lose the election? And then what do they do? Do they say, no, the election was stolen. The votes are rigged. We're not leaving. Or do they say, you know what? That's the way the game is played. That's what the Constitution says. You lose, you step aside. And the appropriate response then is to not contest the election anymore. You lost, but work hard to see if you can win the next election. And so the test of our republic comes in 1800, when the party on the outside, the Republicans, Jefferson's party, wins the election, both the congressional elections and the presidential elections. And the world was watching. Americans were watching to see what would the Federalists, the incumbents who've just been booted out, what will they do? Will they go in peace? It turned out that they did. And Jefferson himself called this the Revolution of 1800. And it was all about this turning over in power. And in contrast to the Revolution of 1776, which was a violent military revolution, this was a peaceful political revolution. And that's what he saw as the real triumph of what this generation had produced.
You've written about this period before. You've researched it a lot. Researching for this particular book, any surprises for you that came out of the research process?
Yes. So the person that I had underestimated in the past was James Madison.
Mm.
Because Madison is not the first member of the founding generation to sort of leap off the page and grab you by the throat. George Washington does that with his dignity, with his prowess, simply with his physical presence. Jefferson, he's the philosopher. He's a brilliant writer. And so I've seen Jefferson. Of course, I got to know Benjamin Franklin very well. I wrote an entire book about Franklin. But Madison's the one who's a little bit in the background. Part of it was that his health was not good, so he didn't fight in the Continental Army. He contented himself working in the Virginia Assembly, Virginia State Legislature, and in the Continental Congress. But he was the one who, working behind the scenes, early concluded that these Articles of Confederation are not working and they have to be replaced. And he lined up allies, including Alexander Hamilton, including finally, and crucially, George Washington, into supporting this idea for a constitution to write a convention to write a new constitution. And if you step back and think about it, what he accomplished was nothing less than the overthrow of the government of the United States. Now, it turned out to be a voluntary overthrow because the people in the states voted for this overthrow, but still, it was a very bold thing for a young man to do. And then here's the striking thing. I knew all that part of the story well. But then after he's created this new government, he starts to have second thoughts and think, my gosh, what have we created? So he's the one who is the arch Federalist in the debate over whether we ratify the Constitution. But then he gradually moves away from the Federalist Party and winds up right next to Jefferson in the Republican side. And it's Madison, and you can really encapsulate this. Madison originally was opposed to the idea of a Bill of Rights for the new Constitution because he thought it was superfluous. This was a Constitution that granted only the powers that were expressly delegated, and anything else was left out. But in listening to the debates, and this is another thing about Madison, he listened to what other people said, and he changed his mind where appropriate. So he changed his mind and concluded that, yes, we do need a Bill of Rights. And he was, of course, he took the position, if there's going to be a Bill of Rights, I might as well write the Bill of Rights. So he did. And we owe our principal charter of freedom, the shackles that Congress puts on itself, that we have put on Congress, to James Madison, who originally didn't think it was necessary, was opposed to the idea, but changed his mind.
I want to ask you about Adams and Jefferson and their relationship. You close out the book with the wonderful letters that they send back and forth, their last remaining year or so, right? Couple of years of their lives. What were those letters like?
So Adams and Jefferson had been close allies in the fight for independence. They had both been members of the committee that drafted the Declaration of Independence, one from Virginia, the other from Massachusetts. And they had come to respect each other, and they had worked well in tandem. They did through the Revolutionary War. But then during the 1790s, when they found themselves in opposite political parties, they had a falling out. A part of my story that most intrigues me is the personal side that's behind the politics of this all. And it's really impossible to separate personalities from politics because people, they can differ politically, but then they tend to ascribe those differences to personal differences as well. And so from the time that and I should add that under the strange system we had for choosing presidents and vice presidents in the 1790s, Thomas Jefferson, leader of the Republicans, was the vice president under John Adams, leader of the other party, the Federalists. We don't do this anymore for very good reason, because it was extremely uncomfortable during that period. But they have a rematch in 1800 and Jefferson wins. And at that point, Jefferson and Adams stop speaking to each other. It's Adams, really, who basically retires to Massachusetts and just doesn't want to have anything to do with Jefferson. Now, they weren't in proximity enough to speak, but they didn't write to each other. And for almost two decades, these men who had been, I would call them, they're certainly friendly. They were friendly enough, and they were close allies and wouldn't have anything to do with each other. It was a mark of how deeply this political division had bled over into personal lives. But then, following the death of Abigail Adams, Thomas Jefferson writes a letter of condolence. And Adams takes this as a human gesture. And he responds. And gradually, it's very touching. It's very touching both in a personal way, but really for the future of the Republic, that these two giants of the founding era, who had been driven apart by partisan politics, who'd finally come back together. And in their later years, they could start to sort of joke a little bit about the things that they had to go through. And they realized that as different as they had become on partisan political matters, there was something still very deep that unified them, their vision for this American experiment in self-government. And of course, it's one of the great stories of American history, how in failing health, each one held on just long enough so that they made it until the Jubilee, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And both died on that day.
Yeah. So the big question that you often get asked, what are the lessons for today from this period?
Whenever I write a book about the past, I think of myself, because it feels like I'm doing this, I've traveled to a foreign country, and the foreign country is the past. And then I return. And I will often say that I've been away, I've been to the past, and I return to the present. And I have bad news, and I have good news. The bad news is, regarding partisan politics, if you don't like partisan politics today, the bad news is it's not going away, because it's been with us for over 200 years. So there's no reason to think it's going to disappear now. The good news is that it's probably not going to kill us, because it hasn't killed us over 200 years. So it's probably not going to kill us now.
And what would you like readers to take away from this book?
Well, two things. One is a sense of the resilience of this country in the face of great challenges. So the kinds of things that people in the 1790s thought were going to blow the place up didn't. So we've done something right to keep this going, but also a sense, and this is going to sound paradoxical, contradictory to what I just said, that there's a potential fragility to this ongoing experiment in self-government. One of the reasons that the election of 1800, where the outs won and the ins were thrown out, one of the reasons it didn't cause violence, it didn't cause a grave disruption, is that the people who had created the system realized, if we don't get this right, we'll lose it. And if we lose it the second time, you know, we lost the first one, the first Articles of Confederation, if we lose this one, then we might simply show that people cannot govern themselves. Now, it's tempting to think 200 years later that, you know, the way things turn out was kind of inevitable. When grand stories unfold, there's a sense of inevitability about them. And it's all, oftentimes Americans look on their political system as though, you know, you can beat it around and it's still going to be there. Well, it's not. I think the lesson to take from this is the lesson of the Federalists and the Republicans in 1800. They had this election. It was a tough election. It was a bitter election. But at the end, the two sides agreed. We got a winner and we had a loser. And we don't have to destroy the system over it. So cherish the system we've got, and also make sure we don't screw it up, because it doesn't go of itself. We have to make it happen.
He is H.W. Brands. The book is Founding Partisans, Hamilton, Madison, Jefferson, Adams, and the Brawling Birth of American Politics. Bill, thank you for joining me.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
And this is Speaking of Writers.